This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscawain. We're going to talk about recycling this hour and take some time to question assumptions that we may all have. Should we be trying to get rid of all waste? Should we be trying to recycle everything? What if it doesn't make economic sense? Or what if it's not really even good for the environment? At least it's not as good as we imagine it is for the environment. And we have a guest who has written about this. He wrote a piece in New York Times recently, and an op-ed piece, and it raised a lot of people reacted to it. His name is John Tierney, and he writes the Findings column. It's a science column for the New York Times, and he's co-author of the book Willpower. John Tierney, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Now, a lot of us assume that recycling is a good thing. Some of us were taught in grade school that it's a good thing, that it saves money, it's good for the environment. But you argue that it's just not that simple. And we're going to get into some of the details throughout the program here. But first, I want to know how you got onto this topic of recycling, because you've been working on it for quite a while now, right?
Well, I wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine in 1996 that set a record for hate mail at the magazine. It's called Recycling is Garbage. And you know what? And it really shocked people to hear the idea that recycling wasn't as good as everyone thought. In fact, I talked to various economists, and people were quite skeptical about this, that the idea that you would mandate a certain rate of recycling and that this would make sense. So, and when I looked into it, I found that there was a lot of evidence that recycling really was not living up to its promise. But the reason people didn't hear about it was that there wasn't really anyone with an incentive to against it. You know, recycling was good for green groups liked it. Waste management companies loved it because it drove up the cost of handling waste, and that meant more money for them. And politicians liked it because it appealed to green groups.
Sure.
So.
But, you know, as journalists, one thing we get to do is choose what we work on. How did you decide that this is what you wanted to work on?
Well, it just seemed that it was this big sacred cow that most people assumed something that wasn't true. I used to do a blog at the Times, and my guiding principles were, I'm a contrarian by nature. It was just because an idea appeals to a lot of people doesn't mean that it's wrong. But that's a pretty good working hypothesis. You know, I'm skeptical of conventional wisdom because it tends to be a convenient belief for people, and it's often not based on facts.
Huh. In that 1996 piece, there was a sentence you said, recycling may be the most wasteful activity in modern America, a waste of time and money, a waste of human and natural resources. Let's get into some details about how you reached that conclusion.
Okay. The biggest waste of recycling is that it takes up all this time that we have. I mean, you said that you learned about it in grade school. I went to a third grade classroom where the science class had spent the whole week, you know, studying garbage and getting sermons about doing that. There's just a lot more important things that those children could be learning, and I think there are a lot more important things we can be doing than sorting garbage in our spare time. As far as the other, you know, the direct economic thing is that the recycling movement began, the philosophy that began in the 1970s with the idea that we're running out of everything, that, you know, oil would be $600 a barrel, and we're not going to have enough wood for paper, we're not going to have metals. There was this whole idea that the limits to growth. Then that was abetted in the 1980s when there was this brief shortage of landfill space because new regulations took effect that closed down a lot of the old town dumps and required, you know, new rigorous safeguards on landfills. So people thought that we're suddenly running out of space to bury our garbage, but that turned out not to be true. There's never been the great landfill shortage. And also, we're not running out of these resources either. So we don't have to recycle. The question is, is it cheaper to recycle, and does it really cause environmental benefits? And for some materials like paper and cardboard and aluminum and metals, it's relatively economical to recycle. It can be profitable. It depends, you know, where you live, what the local market is. And there are environmental benefits, mainly that For each ton you recycle, it saves about 3 tons of greenhouse gases because you're not manufacturing a new product. But for most other stuff in garbage, it's much more expensive and less profitable to recycle, and the greenhouse benefits are much smaller. And I think that for those things, it doesn't really make sense. It would make more sense to just put them in a landfill, an environmentally safe landfill, or to incinerate them in a modern incinerator that generates, you know, clean energy and without much pollution.
And so, in writing about this, who are you trying to reach, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, I'd like I'd like public officials to stop thinking that, you know, because it makes sense to recycle some things, it makes sense to recycle everything. Seattle and San Francisco and New York are moving toward this philosophy called zero waste, the idea that we should, you know, that nothing should go in a landfill, we should recycle everything. Well, that's just, it's very expensive. I mean, New York City started its recycling program around 1990 with the idea that it was going to save money. It projected savings. Instead, over the last 25 years, the city has spent at least $1 billion extra on recycling that it would not have spent if it had just put the stuff in a landfill. And that's a lot of money. That could have built dozens of schools. It could have, you know, it could give every kid in high school an iPad. That money could have much better uses, and all of us would have saved a lot of time from sorting garbage.
I want to bring somebody into the conversation who has dedicated his professional life to recycling, really. Ron Gonen is the co-founder and CEO of the Closed Loop Fund, and he's also a former New York City Deputy Commissioner of Sanitation, Recycling, and Sustainability. He joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And your group has got some pretty big backers. You are out there trying to encourage some of those local municipalities to do more recycling. In fact, your group has a goal to divert more than 20 million cumulative tons of waste from landfills within the next 10 years. And just from what we heard there from John Tierney, suggestion that maybe we should be a little more focused on things that are more profitable to recycle.
Well, recycling is extremely profitable for municipalities. First and foremost, it saves municipalities hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, or if you look at municipalities across the United States, billions of dollars, because first and foremost, you're not having to pay to send that material to landfill. For instance, in New York City, the city currently pays $336 million a year to export its waste that's not recycled to landfill. So first and foremost, that's the biggest opportunity for cities, is to significantly reduce their waste management budget. Number two is you reduce a significant risk to the municipality. Namely, landfill space is disappearing. And a good example of that, if we use New York City again, which Mr. Tierney highlighted in his comments, New York City's waste is exported to landfills in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and South Carolina. That's because there are no landfills in New York State or New Jersey or Connecticut that will accept New York City's waste. And this is a major risk for the city, because at any time, Pennsylvania, Ohio, or South Carolina could decide no longer to import New York City's waste, or those landfills could just become full. And then the question becomes, where are you actually going to put this material? Because it's extremely difficult to actually build and permit a landfill, namely because no one wants to live near a landfill. And the third opportunity is you save a significant amount of energy. It's significantly less energy intensive to manufacture products out of recycled material than it is out of virgin material. And the fourth thing is local jobs. When you export your waste to an out-of-state landfill, it's just going to some facility that's a hole in the ground and doesn't employ many people. When you recycle, you create a significant number of local jobs. We have two major recycling facilities in New York City, one in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, one in Staten Island, where New York City's recyclables go, and they both employ a significant number of local New Yorkers. I can go on. There's additional benefits, but those four alone would be great.
Right, and we're going to get into some of those things here. But I want to go back to John Tierney, because I think Ron Gonen did a good job of sort of laying out what are general reactions to both your 1996 piece and your most recent one. So I guess How do you sort of respond to the responses that people
I'd
are?
I'd be glad to do that. Yeah. You know, Ron gave 4 points, and I'll go down them quickly here. When Ron says that it saves money, and he says that New York City saves $336 million that didn't pay to go to a landfill, that is it's true that it saves that money, but it is not saving money at all. I sat down with the Commissioner of Sanitation, and we went over the relevant comparison is what does it cost to landfill a ton of waste and what does it cost to recycle it? Now, yes, when you send waste to a landfill, you pay a fee for that. You also pay a fee when you send waste to be recycled. The city typically spends $75 a ton sending a ton of recyclables to a facility. And they had hoped that it would get a little bit of that money back because they'd be selling the recyclables and there'd be some profit to share. Well, in fact, there's zero profit to share right now. So the city's paying about $75 there. It does pay money to send trash to a landfill, of course. But and that can range up to $100, which is more. But the key fact, the key statistic, is that it costs so much more money to collect recyclables. So the overall, it costs twice as much to collect these 10 of recyclables because the trucks are picking up less at each stop, and there are other mm-hmm. problems with picking them up. So the overall cost of recycling is $720 a ton. That's $300 a ton more than it costs to send that material to a to collect and send it to a landfill.
Okay.
That's why the city, that's why cities always want to cut recycling programs when they have budget problems.
Well, let's, and we're getting into some numbers here, and that can be a little confusing on the radio, but yes. Essentially we're talking a lot about cost and money here. And I wonder, Ron Gonen, I assume that you don't support recycling just because of cost factors. Does it frustrate you when the conversation sort of gets bogged down in the dollars and cents?
Actually, my primary interest in recycling is the economic opportunity. I started my career in the recycling space as an entrepreneur building a recycling company, and then I went into government, and now I'm back in the private sector managing capital, investing in the recycling sector. So the environmental benefits of recycling, I think, are obvious to everyone. We can get into them, but they should be obvious to everyone. My primary interest is in the economic opportunity around recycling. To just cite one of the numbers that
very
Mr.
quickly.
Kiernan just put out there. He's using a half-truth to spin a story. It does not cost $74 to recycle New York City's recyclables. Half of New York City's recyclables are paper and cardboard, which New York City gets paid under a guaranteed contract $10 per ton.
Okay. We're going to talk about that a little bit more when we come back. We do have to take a short break. That was Ron Gonen. He's co-founder and CEO of Closed Loop Fund and former New York City Deputy Commissioner of Sanitation, Recycling, and Sustainability. We also have on the telephone John Tierney, who wrote a column recently in the New York Times that raised a few eyebrows and caused some heated discussion about recycling. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Also email radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady and for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about recycling this hour. We have on the telephone John Tierney, who wrote a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times that questioned some of the assumptions that many of us might have about recycling. And we also have with us from NPR New York, Ron Gonen, co-founder and CEO of the Closed Loop Fund. Now, John Tierney, when you talk about how some people approach recycling, sometimes you talk about it in sort of religious terms. And I wonder, why do you use those religious terms?
Well, if recycling made economic sense, then we wouldn't need laws and subsidies and all these things to make people do it. And when Ron, for instance, talks about that he wants to make this a profitable business, I say, great. If you can make it profitable, then do it. But it hasn't really worked out that way. And I think people see this as more as a ritual for a ritual of atonement, really, because they feel they're wasting too much, and so they do this, and it makes them feel good to do it. And it's certainly been drummed into kids, starting in kindergarten, that we shouldn't waste, and that recycling somehow helps absolves us of our wasteful tendencies. And one of my concerns is that it does so little for the environment that it makes people think that they can that they've atoned for their other environmental sins when they really haven't.
Well, and you say that it appeals especially to people who are a little more affluent than
right,
others.
Because I mean, if you've got a country home or you're flying somewhere on vacation, you know, those have big greenhouse impacts. Recycling a plastic bottle doesn't. So, and you know, but it makes you feel good, and it's similar to sort of the indulgences that the medieval Catholics would do. They would do a ritual, and that would gain you certain, certain number of days, you know, from purgatory.
And Ron Gonen, I mean, I know that your organization wrote kind of a fact check where you took John Tierney's piece and kind of put red marks all over it. It looked like kind of my sophomore English paper that came back from the teacher that you put a bunch of corrections. And one of them was that this isn't, recycling isn't something that just upper middle class people are engaging in.
We found that when you provide people with the proper infrastructure to recycle, they recycle regardless of their income level.
And what do you think of using religious terms like this to kind of talk about sort of blindly following? Because I think a lot of us have sort of engaged in recycling, assuming we've been told it's good. And so what do you think of sort of using these religious terms like that?
Well, recycling is good for both economic and environmental reasons. Whether or not people do it for religious reasons or not, that's not something I'm going to comment on. I think most people recognize it's...
I'm talking more about using religious terms to sort of describe how we subscribe to recycling, as recycling is almost like a religion.
I found that statement to be preposterous. I think most people recycle because it's relatively easy to do, and they recognize that there's significant value to their community. They don't want their tax dollars being used to send material to landfill, and they recognize the environmental benefit of it. I don't think most people view it in any type of religious or spiritual terms. They just recognize that it's the most efficient and proper way to live within their community.
Let's bring a listener into the conversation here. We have Susan from Fort Washington here in Pennsylvania. Susan, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question, and it's been bothering me for some time. Has anyone tracked, when we're talking of the relative costs of recycling versus landfills, of how much water we are wasting when all of us are washing out our bottles and tin cans and putting them clean into a recycling container? That seems to me to be a hidden cost, and it always bothers me when I do it. I wash it out thoroughly and put it in and think, how much water did I just waste doing that?
And John Tierney, you did address this in your
right,
I can't remember which piece.
It's a great question because it is indeed a hidden cost. You know, the Environmental Protection Agency, it calculates how much carbon emissions you're saving when you recycle a plastic bottle. And it figures out, you know, how much energy would it take to make a new plastic bottle, how much energy is involved in recycling it, carting it around. But it begins its calculations once that bottle's at the curb, and it doesn't take into account the water that's used to rinse it. And one very devout environmentalist named Chris Goodall, he's written a whole book on how to live a low-carbon life, and he did the calculations that if you use hot water to rinse that bottle, you may well be putting more carbon into the atmosphere by recycling than you would by landfilling, simply because of that extra energy that you're using to wash the bottle.
So, Ron Gonen, any advice there for Susan and the rest of us? Or, I mean, is there a better way to do that?
The percentage of your recycling stream that actually needs to be washed out is less than 3%. So most of your recyclables are paper, cardboard, water bottles, which obviously don't need to be washed out. So first, it's immaterial in terms of the actual calculation of energy use relative to recycling. So that's first and foremost. Number two is we always encourage everybody to please, you know, eat or use everything that's in that container. And then number two, you don't need to, you know, scrub it or wash it out. It doesn't need to be pristine. It just can't have a quarter or a half of what was in there left in there. So do your best to wash it out, but it doesn't need to be pristine.
Let's go back to the telephone, and we have Brian from New Jersey. Brian, welcome to Radio Times.
Hello. I had a question regarding the plastics and what percentage is actually able to be recycled, of the stuff that we send downstream, how much is reused?
So let's start with John Tierney on that one. The idea of recycling plastic bottles. I know if you're out somewhere and you buy a plastic bottle of water, you're done with it in 5 minutes, and you feel like you should be doing something else with it other than just drinking water out of it. Is that a profitable side of the business, like you were talking about?
Well, I mean, all this depends on local economics, what it is, and it depends a lot on the kind of plastic you're dealing with. One of the reasons that the recycling industry is in trouble these days, that the plants have been closing and they've cut back research, is that there are a lot of new plastic products, these very lightweight plastic envelopes, for instance, or these plastic pouches that food comes in now instead of being in bulky containers. Now, these plastic pouches you make a lot of sense. It's less energy to make them, less energy to transport them because they're so light. But they're very hard to recycle because it's hard to sort them out, and there isn't really that much use for that kind of plastic. So that stuff, I mean, you can technically recycle anything. The question is at what cost?
And Ron Gonen, one of the points that John Tierney makes is that that recycling kind of goes against where we're headed in history, that labor costs are going up while sort of resource costs are going down. And so sort of preserving resources and spending more labor to recycle them, he argues, essentially doesn't make sense.
We look at commodity prices over 5, 10, 15, 20 years. We don't look at what the market did last week or last month. And if you look at commodity prices over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they're going up, number one. Number two is if you look at the amount of consumption that's forecasted in the United States, or as people are able to consume more in Brazil or China or India, there's going to be a major strain on resources and commodities. So that's number one. Number two is most recycling today in major cities is done with very advanced technology. So I would welcome anybody who lives in New York City to go visit the recycling facility in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. You'll see amazing optical sorters that can pull out all the different materials and separate them. You have one of these facilities as well in Philadelphia. And so I don't view that as an issue at all. I see recycling becoming more and more important and valuable to cities as well as companies as we have more and more people on this earth.
And let's go back to the telephone. We have Pat in Northeast Philadelphia. Pat, welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, hi there. Yes, I just got back from visiting my daughter and my newborn granddaughter in Toronto, and they have a full recycling program. And she lives in a high-rise apartment building, and she puts everything mixed, the glass, cans, foil, even styrofoam, everything, the plastics and all, they go into one bin, and the cardboard and paper go into another bin, and then they have a little compost bin you can set up yourself just with a little container and a bag, a plastic bag, as a liner, and she puts all her garbage into that, and then she has a separate container for the used diapers, which Toronto mandates that they be recycled. And they go in with the garbage. So it's a pleasure not to keep that in the apartment, the diapers and all. They go out to the compost bin. It's just outside the back entrance to the apartment.
And it's all required recycling there, Pat?
Yes, it is. And they use the stuff they compost. They use it in their public gardens. They have a lot of public gardens there, very well maintained, and you know, a lot of parkland.
Okay. So, John Tierney, I guess this is exactly what you're talking about here, this idea that if recycling some things is good, recycling everything is better, and some cities are actually require it.
Right, and you're getting where there are recycling police that are, you know, in Seattle that are going around and looking in garbage cans to make sure that you're only allowed to put, you know, X percent of this. And I mean, my feeling is that people who like to recycle, you know, great. I don't begrudge them it. You should do it if you like doing it. And certainly when recycling makes economic sense, it will happen on its own. People do that, but people have been predicting for decades that we're going to run out of resources, we're going to run out of landfill space, it's all going to make economic sense, but the economics haven't really changed, and that's why there are all these requirements, and I just don't think that it should be mandatory. It's fine if you want to recycle, if it makes you feel good, if you think you're helping things, do it, but don't make everyone else do it.
Ron Gonin, though, this is a country that sort of takes collective decisions, decides we're going to go this direction, and does it periodically. I guess recycling would be one of those things.
It is one of those things in half of the United States. So back to Tierney's comments earlier about it being this religious thing across the United States. Unfortunately, half the United States actually doesn't have curbside recycling programs, which is something that we're looking to invest in and build. All of those cities want recycling programs because they recognize it's an opportunity for them to save a significant amount of money. In terms of the caller's example of Toronto, it's actually an excellent example. I'm glad the caller brought it up because they have one of the most advanced recycling programs in the world, and they're a perfect example of a city that, number one, is recognized they can save a significant amount of money by diverting waste from landfill, but they've also recognized the risk in sending things to landfill, which is Toronto's waste used to go to a landfill in Michigan. And they recognize that, one, it's very expensive, but number two, there's a major risk involved. If the state of Michigan decides it no longer wants to import garbage from other countries into its state, it's going to run into a major problem in terms of where to put its garbage. So Toronto is a great example of a high-functioning recycling program that lots of people participate in and saves the city a lot of money and reduces risk.
One thing I want to ask about, when I'm in my late 40s, and there was a time where, you know, I separated every single little thing, and it felt like it was the right thing to do to, like, make sure that all the glass goes to one place and all the metal goes to another place, and now it all gets sort of thrown in one big container altogether, and it's hard to kind of trust that that's actually going to go somewhere where it's going to be helpful when, you know, a bunch of water from a bottle just spilled on the paper that was below that. There's kind of a psychology thing going on here, isn't there? I'm not sure which of you wants to address that, but... Let's start with Ron Gonin, then we'll have you pick that up, John Tierney. So, Ron Gonin?
Okay. What you're referring to is single-stream recycling, which is a major advancement in the recycling industry in the last 10 years, which is technology that can use what's called optical sorters to look at a conveyor belt full of material and actually pull out the aluminum, the plastic, the paper, and the glass. And that's been a major advancement because it's enabled people to put all the recyclables in one container, which is much more convenient, and it also reduces collection costs because now you're collecting all that material together. And you're seeing single-stream spread across the country rapidly.
And John Tierney, the single-stream recycling, is that an efficient way to do it?
Well, I mean, I like that approach in some ways because it's efficient of people's time. It doesn't force people to spend, you know, homeowners and, you know, and to spend a lot of time sorting garbage for, you know, for no pay. So it has that advantage. On the other hand, the recyclers I've talked to, you know, say it's harder for them because it's just more expensive to separate all this stuff. And as you say, things get contaminated. I mean, some things like glass, for instance, you know, it just routinely breaks. You've got all these pieces of broken glass to deal with to pick out, which damages the recycling machinery, and then you end up with a bunch of glass that, you know, that you can't really sell. You have to pay someone to take it off your hand. So, you know, either way, it's inefficient in some way.
And so you talked about glass there, and you've mentioned that there are some things that are profitable to recycle and some things that aren't. What are some of the most profitable things?
Well, you know, cardboard, paper, and metals are the things that do most for the environment, and that a lot of this stuff happens on its own. I mean, you know, Walmart's going to send all its cardboard boxes to be recycled because it's cheaper than landfilling it. And you don't have to have a law, and you don't have to, you know, have sermons to tell people to do what makes economic sense. But so those things, and a lot of that would happen anyway without this, you know, these artificial goals that we have to have 50% or 75%. You know, we should let people recycle where it makes sense, and that will happen.
So, John Tierney, you wrote your first piece in 1996. Yeah, you wrote the op-ed piece here a couple of weeks ago. Why did you want to bring this issue back up again, especially if that first one got so much hate mail?
Well, I don't mind the hate mail. I mean, that comes with the territory of telling people something that... But the editors simply asked me. They wondered what had changed in 20 years. And when I looked into it, not much had really changed. If anything, in some ways, things have gotten worse because we're trying to recycle so much more stuff now that doesn't really make sense.
And Ron Gonin, the picture you paint of the recycling business sounds a lot more dynamic than that.
The recycling industry is extremely dynamic and very valuable. It's not without its challenges like any other industry, but within those challenges you look for opportunities. But if you look at the last 20 years, there's been tens of billions of dollars from private markets interested in profit invested in recycling industry. And I'm not sure why Mr. Tierney would say that not much has changed in New York City alone, where he lives. You have two of the most advanced recycling facilities in the world that have been built in the past 20 years. So that by itself is a major advancement. But it's a very dynamic industry, and it creates tremendous value for lots of players all along the supply chain.
Hmm. You know, there's kind of a saying sometimes that it doesn't matter if the press is good or bad. It's only if they spell your name correctly. I wonder, Ron Gonen, I'm not sure we would be talking about recycling on the second hour of Radio Times today if it were not for John Tierney's piece and the controversy that it raised. So is overall, do you see this as a good or a bad thing that it's been raised in this sort of context?
Well, I think a healthy argument about the value of things is always good. I think what we found unfortunate about the piece was that some of the facts and figures were either incorrect or pushing a story that we didn't think was accurate. So we found that to be unfortunate. But I think a healthy dialogue is always critical. As I mentioned, there are some challenges to the recycling industry, and it's an area that, like any other industry, can always be improved. But at the end of the day, it creates tremendous value for municipalities, for taxpayers, and for our environment.
All right. That's Ron Gonen. He's co-founder and CEO of the Closed Loop Fund and former New York City Deputy Commissioner of Sanitation, Recycling, and Sustainability. Thank you much for being with us today. And also on the telephone, we had John Tierney. He writes the Finding Science column for the New York Times, and he's co-author of the book Willpower. And if you haven't already read his op-ed piece, look it up, and it'll send you into thinking more about your thoughts on recycling. Coming up next, we are going to talk about packaging when Radio Times continues. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, sitting in for Marty Moskowane. And we're going to spend the last 20 minutes of our program talking about packaging. The holidays are coming up and the packages are going to start piling up. And we're wondering, are there ways to kind of reduce all that cardboard and plastic and packing peanuts and bubble wrap? It just seems to kind of collect in the basement at my house, I have to tell you. And joining us is Nina Goodrich. She is executive director of Green Blue and director of the Sustainable Packaging Coalition. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Jeff, very much. Delighted to be here.
Yeah. First of all, just tell me a little bit about your group, Green Blue. People may not have heard of it before.
Sure. So Green Blue is the parent company. It's an environmental nonprofit that provides science and resources to help businesses be more sustainable. And one of the things that we look at are helping companies manage their materials more sustainably. So the Sustainable Packaging Coalition was started in 2004, and it's one of the most successful initiatives of Green Blue, and it's really brought together hundreds of companies since that time, working together to help broaden their understanding of packaging sustainability and really to create meaningful developments through, you know, influencing the conversation that's going on, such as conversations today, enhancing supply chain collaboration, and ultimately creating action to make more sustainable packages.
It's kind of surprising when you sit back and think about that there is a whole sector of the economy of people thinking about how stuff gets to you and what it's packaged in. But it's out there. It's a big business, right?
Absolutely, it is. And one of the things that's really starting to dominate our conversation, and it follows on really nicely from the conversation that you just had, is we're trying to think of really materials as currency, to move away from this sort of take-make-waste thinking and really think much more in a much more circular way, so that we can think about these materials that we're using for packaging as inputs for other processes or other materials. And I think that's really how we get away from thinking about packaging as waste. It's not waste. It's a really valuable material that can be repurposed and reused.
Listeners, when was the last time you had somebody on the line to talk about how stuff gets to you and what it's packaged in? If there's something that's always just kind of bugged you, this is your chance to ask Nina Goodrich about it. The telephone number is 1-888-4- 877-9499. The email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Nina, when you walk into a grocery store, what do you see that just kind of bugs you? Or so, what do you see that you'd like to change? Just name a couple things.
One of the things I'd like to change is I would like people to think about, again, packaging, when they're designing packaging at the beginning, to think about how it's going to be used and what its next life is going to be. So the idea of creating packaging from materials that are recyclable and then can be incorporated back into packaging materials, that's one of the things that I like to see. I like to see materials that are renewable. Those are things, paper is a renewable resource. Lots of people don't think of it that way, but absolutely it is. And also some of the exciting new developments in the area of biopolymers.
You mentioned there paper is a renewable resource. But one of the interesting points that John Tierney makes, our previous guest who wrote the op-ed column in the New York Times, this really sort of struck me, because when I walk into a grocery store and I see things like cucumbers wrapped in plastic, my first reaction is, well, that's crazy. There's already like a wrapper on it. I mean, I go and peel off the wrapper when I want to cut up the cucumbers. But John Tierney says it's a little more complicated than that, that the plastic preserves the food inside and makes it less likely that it's going to spoil, and which means we just throw it away.
Yes. I mean, you've just brought up a really good point. So one of the areas that we struggle with in the U.S. is food waste. Food waste is an enormous part of our solid waste disposal problem. So that thin piece of plastic is actually keeping your cucumber fresh and the way that you want to eat it for days longer than it would be able to be kept fresh if you didn't have it. So, and if you want to think of the environmental footprint of producing food is pretty large. You have fertilizers, you have water, you have a significant amount of energy going into producing and transporting that cucumber. So if you can make that cucumber last even 5 more days, it's a huge saving. So packaging actually extends the shelf life of food products that help us overall.
Let's bring a listener into the conversation here. We have Heidi from Wilmington. Heidi, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I work in the Harley-Davidson industry, where I receive a lot of packages. And in those packages, there's things like clothing and leather jackets. And within those, there's almost invariably desiccants used. And I was just wondering if there's any nationwide reuse of desiccants, or can desiccants be reused?
What is desiccant? I don't know what that is.
Desiccant is that it's like a silicon-based package that you put in with clothing to keep it fresh, or for molding, or to keep the leather smelling fresh.
Oh, so like those little packages that have some sort of powder or something in them?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, Nina Goodrich, desiccant. I'm learning something new here today.
I'm afraid to say I don't know the answer to that question, but it's a great question. And what I would encourage you to do is to contact the folks that are packaging, find out who the supplier of that desiccant is, and call them, because chances are there is an opportunity for collection and reuse, and they would be the ones to ask that question to.
You know, Amazon, that company is really popular. And on my street, just outside of Philadelphia here, the truck shows up almost every day delivering packages to neighbors. And I sometimes think when something arrives, it's like, wow, that sort of like arrived at Amazon in a package. They unpacked it, put it on a shelf, and then they just put it in another package to send it to me. Is it better to like get your groceries that way, or to go to a grocery store and just pick it off a shelf?
That's an interesting question. What I think it really depends on, one of the things that and members of the Sustainable Packaging Coalition, we have all the major delivery companies, whether it's U.S. Post Office, UPS, folks like that. And they have gone to great lengths to make their routes extremely efficient and have made sustainability a very high priority. So I think it depends on what you're getting and how much you're getting. The real question of the packaging, though, is if it's coming in a cardboard box, that's a highly valuable material from a recycling point of view. And as long as you take that box and either fill it with things that you want to take to Goodwill or recycle it, then I think you're making the best use of it.
What if that cardboard box has a bunch of tape on the outside, plastic tape? I mean, is that compromising the value, I guess, if you want to recycle it or something, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, the tape, the pulping process can get rid of it, but it's much better if you take that tape off ahead of time.
All right. We also received an email from Rich, and Rich asked, when I go to the pharmacy and get a 90-day supply, I'm given 3 plastic bottles with no recycling triangle on the bottom.
Well, the whole area of pharmaceuticals is a challenging area for sustainability, and that's one that we really want to focus more on in the future. I mean, there are absolutely opportunities to recycle the bottles that pharmaceuticals come in. You have some challenges in terms of getting the personal information off of those bottles and getting the tablets out, but there are many cities that are starting to set up programs for take-back programs for those containers. So it really depends. They can be made of different materials. Again, I would ask your pharmacy specifically what that material is so that you know how to recycle it. One of the things that we offer is a how-to-recycle label that brands can actually put on their packaging that gives them and gives the consumer an idea of what they're supposed to do with this particular package. Is it widely recycled, or is it something where they have to check locally to determine whether or not their municipality takes it? So I would recommend that.
So you're really focused on this beginning part of the process. Somebody's designing a new product. They're designing the packaging for it. You want them to think more about where that packaging is going to end up. And I wonder if there's like one big thing that you see all the time that you just think, like, it just would be so simple to change that, and nobody's changing it.
I think that, one of the things that we want if we're recovering a material is we want quantity and we want quality. So uncontaminated material streams. And so sometimes people have a perfectly good recyclable package and then they do something to it that makes it unrecyclable. So those are the types of instances where if they were just thinking from the beginning about what the end of life of this package is going to be, an example are shrink sleeves. And there's been a tremendous amount of work on those sleeves that go all over the PET bottles to make them more colorful or more interesting to consumers. And I have to say the industry has really banded together to work really hard on coming up with a way to make those sleeves so that the bottles are, in fact, recyclable. So when challenges like this occur, the industry has come together to try to solve those problems.
And how did they do that? What did they do to the plastic label around the plastic bottle to make the bottle more recyclable?
Well, the issue was that the label was difficult to separate in the recycling stream once you grind the bottle up, and it had the same density so that you couldn't pull them apart. Usually you float plastics in water and some of them sink and some of them float, and that's how you can separate them. And in this particular case, the labels were getting mixed in. So what they did is they changed the density of the label so that it could be separated.
Huh, interesting. All right, let's go back to the telephone. We have Richard from Westchester in Pennsylvania. Richard, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. I was wondering what kind of impact the packaging industry is making in terms of lobbying on progressive legislation, especially regarding the disposal and the possible recycling of packaging material. And as a as an adjunct to that, the fast food industry seems to me to be a particular violator of wasteful packaging and perhaps unnecessary packaging, and are they involved in that kind of a lobbying effort as well?
Huh. Nina, is there a big lobbying campaign among packaging people?
Well, as an environmental nonprofit, we of course don't get involved in lobbying. But what I would say is there are a number of voluntary efforts within industry to tackle some of the different types of packaging problems. And that's where an organization like ours, who helps to bring together the whole supply chain to have these conversations when there are difficult issues, is how we've been approaching it. But there are, the city of Seattle was mentioned a little bit earlier, and they, of course, have a pioneering program in composting all of the food service ware in the city of Seattle needs to be compostable. And the reason that they've done that for fast food or any takeout restaurants is so that they can capture the food waste, because they recognize that that food waste is really valuable and you don't want it going to a landfill where it's just going to produce methane. What you want is to capture that and turn it into compost. So by working, the city working with the different merchants and brands to encourage compostable packaging, they actually went from 70 options for compostable packaging to over 500 different options. And it's really doing two things. It's reducing the waste that goes to landfill, and it's recapturing and repurposing both the food and the package for compost. So I think that's a really exciting experiment.
And compostable packaging, is that the same thing as biodegradable packaging?
No, I'm glad you asked. So the difference, biodegradable is an often misused word because there are no time or temperature constraints on it. So the beauty of compostability is that the material needs to degrade within a certain time frame, and it has to reach certain temperature and moisture considerations. So it's all grounded in science, and there are tests that you can do to determine whether or not your material is compostable. So I like to use the word compostable as opposed to biodegradable.
Huh. And we have just about a minute left here, but maybe talk a little bit about some of the interesting things that you're seeing in compostable packaging. What are some unique things happening out there?
Well, there's some crazy things, such as edible cups made from agar that are compostable. But there are also, I think we really need to think about the mainstream here as opposed to some of the things that are on the periphery. And so some of the exciting things that are happening is that new plastics can actually be made from food waste and compost. So there's an area where we're taking materials and then we're repurposing them by using microorganisms to create new materials. So I think that's one of the most exciting areas, is the whole area of biopolymers, where we're creating new materials from old materials, using plants to do it, and taking care of atmospheric carbon as well as methane in some circumstances to make these new materials. So I think that's an exciting front.
Huh. And is there a sense that this is a place where companies want to invest a lot of money, that there's a lot of money to be made there, just very quickly?
It's emerging. It's not mainstream yet. But I think in the future, when we run out of some of our fossil-based raw materials, this will absolutely be the foundation for the future. So I would leave you with renewable, recyclable, compostable, and recoverable.
That's Nina Goodrich. She's Executive Director of Green Blue and Director of the Sustainable Packaging Coalition. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to our Twitter handle, our Facebook feed is there, and there's information on podcasts, where to find us on satellite radio, our archives, email contact info, and more. The engineer today is Kevin Griffin. The producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.